Breadbox Media Programming is brought to you by...
Are you looking to serve God and society? Consider putting your gifts to work as a lawyer. Ave Maria School of Law has been educating faith-filled lawyers for over 20 years. Ave Maria School of Law is committed to training lawyers to use law appropriately around the moral issues of our time. Visit avemarialaw.edu to learn more about integrating your faith with a law degree.
Looking for a way to build daily prayer discipline? Seen the rise in mindfulness meditation, but not sure if it is possible to meditate in a way that's consistent with your Catholic faith? Just looking for a way to breathe new life into your existing prayer routine? No matter what you're looking for, Hollow is here to help. Hollow is a Catholic prayer and meditation app that helps users deepen their relationship with God through audio-guided contemplative prayer sessions. From meditations on the daily gospel, to the rosary, to daily examines, Hollow has something for everyone. Hollow is the number one Catholic app in the U.S. It is free to download and has permanently free content, but you can also check out all of the premium sessions for 30 days, risk-free, by signing up at www.hollow.app/breadbox.
Yep. Yep, that's our music. That it is. And we're back. Beneath the Surface live for the first time in a couple of 3 weeks. Good evening, ladies and gentlethings. Good to be back in the WCAP studios. I'm Paul Morano. This is Beneath the Surface, where faith and reason meets every Monday evening between 10 and 11 p.m. Glad you could join us tonight as we bring a little sanity into our age of insanity, a little life into our culture of death. Tonight, before I get into the topic and before I introduce my guest, I have not seen Cindy behind the glass for at least 3 weeks. Cindy, how was your holidays?
It was okay.
Okay, that's good. Well, how are you doing? All right?
Yeah, I'm good.
Yeah? Good, good. Good to see you. I see you're still working here. Always good to see you behind the glass. And in front of me is my guest tonight, a BTS regular, for all of you BTS listeners. I tell you what, I'm not going to introduce him. But person, say a little something, and maybe my audience will know who you are.
Well, there's a standing joke where I say, "Hello, Paul." But I'm not sure anybody gets it except the two people in this room.
Yes.
Why don't you ask me how my holidays were?
How were your holidays, Mr. Guest?
My holidays were testing out a thing. I posted on Facebook and I said, give thanks to the Lord in all circumstances.
Okay.
It was from Thessalonians. I'm not sure which it was, but and so on Christmas Day I got the flu and I was sick all the octave of Christmas.
Wow, did you give thanks for it?
I think I forgot to give thanks for getting the flu.
Oh, that's a shame. Wow. All that wonderful opportunity to offer up such sickness and ill health.
Right.
And you forgot to do it.
Yeah, I was preoccupied, I think.
I see. Well, maybe you can try to do it retroactively.
Yes. Yeah. Thank the Lord for my illness during Christmas season.
And for your very being, as you and I have reiterated over and over on Facebook, it's better, much better, infinitely better to be while being sick than to not be at all.
Well, you know, that is very true. I am sounding like I'm complaining, I think, maybe, but that I was sick during the time. But actually, there is joy therein. I'm not depressed or Actually, in a certain way, here's the way I can find thanks, because it was, I think it did help me in my prayers.
Ah, your prayer life got better.
I think so. Improved. I think it was. It's over the Advent, Christmas, even continuing
well,
into some, now.
Sometimes there's nothing better than a good dose of suffering to bring you back to reality.
Right. I do feel closer, really, seriously, than before the Advent season started.
Yes. Well, congratulations.
Ah.
There he is. You heard him. You heard him. His name is Mr. Bob LeBlanc. Bob, welcome to Beneath the Surface.
Woohoo! Thank you for having me.
And you are not to be confused with the Bob the Blank, Bob the Blank. Well, actually, is that what it means in French?
Yes.
Okay.
It, the masculine form of the what is the that is the indefinite article.
And
right?
Is blank the French version of blanco, which means white?
It's white. Yes.
Okay. So Bob the white guy. Is that fair enough?
I don't know if it was just the white. You know, I'm not sure. I've looked it up.
And
it could be a person who had blonde hair, meaning the white hair. Or it could mean the paleness of their skin.
All right, so welcome, Bob the White Guy, to Beneath the Surface. 978. 9784. Well, you don't have white hair, so what am I supposed... Well, it's kind of getting there, but it's not there yet.
Yeah,
so
not
what am I supposed to
gray
say?
Yet, yeah.
978-454-4980 is our phone number. 978-454-4980 if you want to get involved in our conversation tonight. And as we delve beneath the surface on the topic of Dr. Martin Luther King in his letter written from the Birmingham jail, what does it say? And what are its ramifications for other movements? To yak beneath the surface with you and I about that is my guest, Mr. Bob LeBlanc. All right. So, Bob, it is getting close to Martin Luther King Day.
We are on Martin
I'm sorry. Luther King. It's that
yes,
close.
You're very close. You're like right on the money.
Actually, we're sitting on it, yes. So it is Martin Luther King Day. And Martin Luther King obviously stood for civil rights, which he claimed were human rights, rights that were not being recognized by the state authority. And so, in short, he recognized that civil rights were not in line with human rights. And when that happens, then, if you're not a cultural relativist, there is room for protest, for peaceful protest, and even peaceful disobedience, and trying to change not only the law, but in turn, the society itself. So, how would you like to start this conversation about the letter? From Birmingham.
Why don't we just start with some light biographical sort of items?
Sounds
today,
good.
Today is Martin Luther King Jr.'s birthday as well.
Okay.
He was born on January 15th, 1929.
Oh.
And he was not...
Well, 5 days younger than my father.
Is that right?
Who I just visited in Florida, and he just turned 89. God bless him.
Yeah, that would be about his age
today.
Yeah. And here's the interesting thing that I've learned in the past few years. He was not born as Martin Luther King Jr.
That was not his name.
That was not his original name on his birth certificate. It was not Martin Luther King.
Enlighten us, please.
So, at some time after Martin Luther King was born, his father, who he was named after, and originally his father's name was Michael King, and he went to visit Germany, and he was really impressed with Martin Luther, so he decided to change his name to Martin Luther King Sr.
Ah, so were the Kings Lutheran?
No, they were Baptists.
Oh, yes. He was a Baptist minister, I believe, right?
Yes, he was a Baptist. His father was a Baptist minister, and Junior followed in his footsteps.
Okay, so he was born Michael King?
He was born Michael King Jr., and his father changed his name, and he got his son's name changed as well.
Very interesting little
King
bit
Jr.
of information. Thank you.
Yeah, it's... I think that pretty much plumbs the depth of my knowledge of Martin Luther King, except that he went to college very early. I think he was 15 years old when he went to college.
Right?
Yeah, he wanted to just get straight through high school. He skipped two grades.
I don't blame him.
He eventually got his doctorate at Boston University.
Yes.
Yeah, and he goes back south, gets married, becomes a pastor of a Baptist church in Alabama. He was born in Georgia, but he moved to Alabama. I don't know why. He was very, very early on involved. His dad was involved in civil rights movement. He was opposed to segregation. I don't know if you have ever heard from your history lessons in high school. Maybe you've forgotten that there was this idea that Southern states were trying to pull. They were saying, "What we'll have, what will be here is separate but equal."
Yes.
And we call that segregation now, but that was their way of saying, "Yeah, we're not really doing anything against the black people or anything like that. We're just going to be, they're going to be equal, but they're going to be on a different place," kind of thing.
Yeah. Before we even get any further, do you think that concept is possible to be equal while intentionally separated?
Well, historically, it was subject to abuse. It was really just a cover for discrimination and oppression. I suppose in the abstract you could say, yeah, that's sort of possible, but I don't really see that actually coming out in a concrete sort of way.
I don't know. Canada just popped into my head. You've got two very different cultures, both speaking different languages.
Yeah.
Is in one government, of course, one overarching government saying, okay, you two halves of Canada are separate, obviously, in many ways, but we will consider you equal. Could you do that with various peoples?
I think you start running into like the Balkan situation where the Austro-Hungarian Empire, or what happened to Yugoslavia. You have
to the Kurds up in Iraq during Saddam.
Right, right. It's very difficult to manage it. I mean, it's happened. Hungarian Empire that was held together fairly well for a long period of time, but it was weak toward the end there.
How does Canada do it?
Well, I don't know if it's really doing it. Quebec had a referendum to separate from Canada, and it was almost 50%. They almost reached the 50% mark. That was really close, and I'm not sure if they really want to separate, whether that would be good for them. They're getting a lot of benefits in this separate but equal situation.
You're more in tune with Canada being French-Canadian than I am.
I follow the news for that, yeah.
Does French Canada feel... what is the word? Maybe inferior or discriminated against in any way, or lesser than English-speaking Canada?
Well, their concerns are more about preserving the culture and the language.
Mm. And there's a fear that that's not going to...
The French-speaking Canadians are a minority in Canada. And you notice like things like television networks and things like that. They're mostly English, and plus they've kind of broken themselves off from American television, and they're trying to produce their own sort of stuff. It's still, I think, the majority is still English speaking TV channels, radio stations, except when you talk about Quebec, where obviously they have the majority. In Quebec.
So basically, Quebec will be happy as long as the French culture within it is preserved and not usurped by English Canada.
But I do know from personal family history, my family does not come from Quebec. It comes from the Maritime provinces, in particular New Brunswick, and New Brunswick is like 40% French. But during the time of my grandmother in the 50s and the 60s, the French-speaking Canadians were kind of like second-class citizens.
Yeah.
If they went to an English city and went into a store, they'd better speak English. They weren't going to be served if they spoke French.
All right, so then it seems the norm that when you do have this kind of divided nation, you do have classes.
Yeah, there is that kind of situation. Yeah.
Either recognized or unrecognized.
Right. In the South, it was blatantly open. It was, you know, enshrined in laws. You had,
right.
You had, you know, blacks having to sit in the back of the bus. You had in public transportation. If they went to a store or a restaurant or something like that, they'd have to go to the back or in separate sort of seating.
Right, not using the same water fountains.
Right, all that sort of stuff. So it was definitely much deeper than I think what's going on in Canada.
And of course, in major sports, Jackie Robinson was a milestone figure.
Right.
And then from there, of course, they began to the Negro Leagues began to the players began to go into the major leagues, and even now there are. There have been several black hockey players from the National Hockey League,
right.
Which was unheard of just a couple of decades ago.
Right, but I don't think that was discrimination. I think there just there weren't enough black athletes in the sport of hockey
went into hockey.
That went into hockey. Yeah.
Okay, so the idea during Martin Luther King's time was. Or at least the Southern idea was separate but equal.
Right.
All right. So that didn't work out.
Well, it was definitely true. I mean, looking at it's a historical fact that the blacks were being oppressed in the South, and you would probably say that it was nationwide. Even in the northern cities, you know, the blacks didn't get the best opportunities there, but. There was such a huge presence of black people in the southern states, and they were treated, you know, as, you know, an underclass. So I think there was some sort of what word I'm looking for is kind of like a critical mass, I guess, of things happening. You know, there.
Okay. Well, at this point, slavery had been abolished for about 100 years.
Well, we're probably about the 75-year mark in when
Martin Luther King lived.
Yeah, when he was born, at least.
When he was born, so you were you had a situation where white people and black people for 75 years were beginning to integrate as one nation, as one people, and it wasn't all that easy. Doings.
Right. Even in the U.S. Army, you know, the army is. You had segregation within the units. They wouldn't mix blacks and whites together.
Now should I assume that virtually all black people wanted to be integrated into mainstream society?
Well, I think that's safe to say because they realized they weren't getting the first class stuff.
Yes.
You know, in the segregation sort of thing.
But were there a percentage of black people who said, who needs their stuff? We should just do our own thing.
It's mentioned a little bit in the letter from the Birmingham jail about black nationalism popping up. So he was trying to contrast this because it truly was true that blacks were proud to be American. At that time, it wasn't out. They didn't hate, but there were blacks that hated the idea of America. They wanted to be what I think white nationalists wants now is let us be separate from these other people and not even mix together with them.
So separatists are not simply white; they are black too.
Right.
And tell me. Your understanding of the difference between the movement led by Dr. Martin Luther King and that sub-movement led by Malcolm X and the Black Panthers.
He actually mentioned that. He mentioned it was Elijah Muhammad was the precursor to what we call the Nation of Islam now, with Louis Farrakhan.
Yeah.
And he was mentioned, and they were mentioned as black nationalists. The way that Martin Luther King describes it in the letter from a Birmingham jail, and from now on I'll just say it's the letter rather than repeat that all the time.
Well, I don't know. Some people might be tuning in. yeah, you might as well just say the whole thing.
Martin Luther King noticed that there was a certain bitterness and hate associated with these black nationalist movements.
Yeah.
And the approach that Martin Luther King wanted to take was one of love. I mean, he was going to protest. There's no doubt about him wanting to create some sort of tension, but it wasn't out to kind of destroy things. He wanted to improve the lot of black people. He wanted to integrate us. He was so... I mean, he spoke of the Supreme Court case in 1954 outlawing segregation. As in public schools. He said that was a positive thing.
Seems to me what you're saying is that sometimes love is tough.
Right.
And love always focuses on the act or the idea to combat, never directly on persons.
Right.
So he didn't hate, Martin Luther King, at least theoretically, did not hate the persons who were discriminatory. He hated discrimination.
Right. Well, I mean, he did mention people, segregationists, in his letter.
With hate?
Well, not with hate, but I mean, he was not happy with these people. We could say that.
Okay.
Definitely true. He saw the segregationists as oppressors.
Did he mention them by name?
He mentioned. Connor or O'Connor, who was the mayor of Birmingham at the time, and he actually for the protests that they were going to do in Birmingham, he waited until after the election. He didn't want to affect the election by his protests. He wanted a more moderate segregationist to get elected. And so he was smart enough to realize that if I protest now, I'm probably going to help my enemy.
I see. So strategically, he waited.
And a lot of the letter is talking about waiting, in the long term, strategy, because the Birmingham letter was in response to white clergy who were very angry at Martin Luther King. Here's one of the things. I read the letter probably in the mid-1990s.
Okay.
And I reread it today just to, freshen up on it. And the thing that I discovered is it was enlightening in the fact that the more things change, the more things stay the same.
Yeah.
Here's one of the things that stuck out for me is that he was called an extremist. Martin Luther King was called an extremist, and look, he wasn't like the black nationalists at this time. He could look to people who were saying, we want to have violence right now. We want to
violent revolution.
Violent revolution against the state, because it's obvious that the state was oppressing black people at the time. His entire thing, the what he was trying to defend in this letter was nonviolent direct action. And that was the key thing for him. It was nonviolent. He wasn't trying...
This reminds me of the Sermon on the Mount.
Yes.
Where Jesus said... it used to be said, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth.
Right.
But I say to you, turn the other cheek. If your enemy hits you on one cheek, turn the other one. If he wants your cloak, give him your coat as well. If he wants you to go a mile, go 2 miles with him. In other words, don't be a doormat, but but hold your ground, do what is right and true, and do not hate your enemy, but try to, with your enemy, go towards deeper truth together.
Right. And the thing about this is it wasn't it wasn't a passive thing. The other part of that is the direct action part. He was agitating. He was agitating, but he was agitating in a peaceful way. He was confronting his oppressors and saying, "How dare you?" That, in a sense,
he didn't back down.
He didn't back down.
And I think that's what Jesus was saying when he said, "Turn the other cheek." See, if somebody hits you on one cheek, most people would just turn away or run away and leave the situation.
Or they might strike back violently.
Or the opposite. They might strike back violently. Jesus was saying neither one is true. Is the best response. The best response is to hold your ground firmly, do what is right, and take the hit.
Right.
And continue to go firmly with the grace of God. And it seems like that's what Martin Luther King was trying to say. Don't go one way. Don't be a wimp. And don't be a fool that strikes back violently, but go steady, straight, according to what is true and good, and eventually you'll win.
Right, right. And he was very pointed about this, is that he was training his protesters not to respond to violence, to take the violence, take it, but not respond violently in retaliation.
Okay, on Martin Luther King Day here, 2018. We're talking about Dr. Martin Luther King and his letter from the Birmingham jail. More detail, more Beneath the Surface thoughts on that letter after this. You're listening to Beneath the Surface. I'm Paul Morano on WCAP Radio. Going to have to take a break. Be right back. Don't go anywhere. And we're back. 978-454-4980 is our phone number. Here at Beneath the Surface Radio, WCAP. Paul Morano, sitting in as your host, as usual, and as always. And it's good to be back. Haven't been here live for the past 3 weeks. Actually, I was in sunny Florida. And I completely missed all the horrible cold and snow that was here for the past 3 weeks. But I heard a lot about it through the internet, Bob.
I see. Well, we're getting a little bit of a cold snap this weekend.
Here. We are, but were those 3 weeks as miserable as it seems, as the news made it seem?
Well, I mentioned that I was sick.
That's right. So you were miserable anyway.
I was miserable anyways. I didn't really go outside all that much.
But I understand there's going to be some more snow beginning tomorrow night.
Yes, I heard that too. Yeah.
Might be a snowy
winter.
We've
gotten a lot of snow, except the snow is melted and, it's coming back.
Well, they had no snow in Birmingham, Alabama at the time of Martin Luther King wrote his letter when he was put in jail. And that's our topic tonight, the letter from Birmingham jail here on Martin Luther King Day 2018. Bob, why was Dr. King put in jail in the first place?
Well, they were protesting. They were protesting. Yep. They were protesting without a permit, which is mentioned in the letter. The reason was is they weren't going to grant any permit for anybody, protesting. That was it. And he also mentions in his letter the fact that he was willing to go to jail for the sake of breaking these unjust laws.
Okay.
I think that gets passed over quite a bit. Is to say, well, these are unjust laws. I shouldn't go to jail and complain and whine about it like that. That was not his attitude. He was going to protest these laws, and he was going to go to jail for protesting those laws. He is willing to pay the price for it.
Okay, so let's let's continue with the contents of the letter. What else would you like to say about it?
Well, the real meat and potatoes of the letter is where he talks about just and unjust laws. And in fact, he's responding to a letter, or it was written in the newspaper. These various white clergy were saying, these are these sorts of things that you're doing wrong. And one of the things they said is that how can you support, the Supreme Court's decision in outlawing segregation in public schools and then break the law on the other side. He says, how can you justify...
Who's saying this?
This is the white clergy. They're writing a letter. They're protesting. They're saying you're...
By protesting without a permit? Is that what you mean?
Well, protesting without a permit, doing things that are against the segregation laws. You know, by doing all these various things where you're breaking the law, you know, why? How can you justify breaking the law sometimes here and sometimes other times saying, you know, you have to follow the law here?
Now, this is a very, very important question we need to examine right now.
Right.
Because a lot of people would say that you have no right to break the law. If you want things to change, work inside the law.
And that's exactly what these clergy were suggesting. Hey, wait for the courts to make them legal and all that sort of stuff.
Now, then, what was Martin Luther King's justification for breaking some laws but not others?
Okay, well, he's making a distinction between some laws are just laws and some laws are unjust laws.
And based on what? Because, you know, I can hear people saying right now, listening to this radio show...
Yeah, how do you decide that?
Who are you to say what's just and unjust? So, who are we to say? Based on what would he say some laws are just and some are intrinsically unjust?
Okay, well, he introduced St. Thomas Aquinas.
All right.
Into this, which is a very interesting thing for, I think, a Baptist to do. St. Thomas was a Catholic in the medieval time period, around 1250.
And, of course, this is before the Protestant Reformation.
Yes, this is before then.
But the quote-unquote reformers didn't really cling to the teachings of Aquinas like the Catholic Church did.
Right.
Okay.
But he was cognizant. He went to two people. He went to Aquinas and he went to Saint Augustine.
Yes. The two big A's of Christianity.
Yes.
Yeah.
In the Western Church, at least. So he drew on Saint Thomas in talking about eternal law and divine law and natural law.
Yes.
And so he was saying, how do we judge whether the law is just or not? And he made an appeal to eternal law, which is directly from God himself.
So the eternal law is that law which governs the entire universe,
yes,
you would say.
Yep.
As that which is God, or the character of God that emanates throughout his entire creation.
Right.
And one could simply sum it up, I suppose, that the eternal law is truth and love.
Okay, I'll buy that.
You buy that?
Yes.
And of course, that includes justice.
Right.
So that permeates the entire universe.
Right.
But then you said there's another level under that,
right,
that particularly applies to human beings by virtue of their human nature.
Right, natural law.
Okay.
So that is the law that is particular to human beings.
Now, a lot of people would say that sounds like it's the laws of nature. Those are very different concepts, aren't they? Natural law and the laws of nature.
I don't think St. Thomas would really separate the two, because the thing that separates the laws of nature and natural law are the fact that human beings have free will. And
everything has a nature, though, according
right.
to Aquinas.
Yes.
So then the eternal law applies to every nature differently, because every
right.
nature is different.
Right.
So how the eternal law applies to human nature is what is called natural law.
Right.
Okay.
That's right. Yes. So the way they viewed it at that time, I mean, law, there were laws of nature that the order was, the universe was ordered.
Yes.
And they're saying the same thing that applies to human nature. There is a certain order to human nature, and this, you have to work right. within that.
Right, and it's basic morality.
Right.
We find the natural law really in every community, in every society,
right.
since the dawn of mankind.
Well,
in some form or another.
Right. There's certain things that people know, I guess, sort of intuitively.
Yeah.
You would say that there's knowledge that's within them. You know
right.
that it's very wrong to kill another human being.
Sure. Respect legitimate authority. You shall not kill. You shall not commit adultery.
Stealing.
You shall
lying.
Not steal. You shall not lie or slander people. And then there are many others that spring off from those. But in a nutshell, they're the Ten Commandments that
right.
Jews and Christians are familiar with. But in non-Christian societies, they're present too.
Right.
They're just called something different. But they're societies.
Well, yeah.
Societies' morals.
St. Thomas Aquinas would call like the Ten Commandments part of divine law. That is what God revealed to us in the Old and the New Testaments.
But he'd also say what he revealed is actually natural law.
Right. Yeah. The two things stand side by side. The thing that we would say is that, well, human beings are not very good at seeing clearly throughout natural law. There always seems to be some sort of injustice that's involved.
Yeah,
in all
because
this society.
Selfishness and bias take over, and because we are imperfect, fallen human beings, we don't practice or sometimes don't even see natural law clearly.
Right.
And I think this is what Martin Luther King was trying to say regarding human rights. You know, do we all share a human nature or do we not?
Right.
You know, all ethnicities and all races. And if so, then shouldn't we be treated under civil law equally according to what we are as human beings?
Right, right. So what do you do? How do you judge human laws, which is the lowest level for St. Thomas? How do you judge whether these laws are just or unjust? And what you do is you look to see if these human laws are in deviation or in accord with the natural law.
And natural law includes human rights.
Right.
And human goods. And so, apparently, Dr. King recognized what many other people recognized, and that is, it seems like, at least in our society, that certain race of people are not being treated as equals with proper human dignity. And hence, the civil laws that discriminate against these people need to be changed.
Right. And this is the same sort of thing that actually happened for the Civil War. You had the Declaration of Independence saying that all men are created equal.
Yeah.
And obviously, at the time the Declaration of Independence was written, it was not true that all men were
treated equal. Right.
And so you had the
it's funny you say that because the Declaration doesn't say they are treated equal. It just says that they are created equal.
Right, yeah. Right. But the implication, what comes after, seems to be very obvious.
Yes.
You know, if all men are created equal, you need to treat
then they should be treated equal.
They should be treated equal.
Yes.
And so we had a civil war almost. You know, we had a civil war 70 years. I think it's 80 years.
Okay.
87 years afterwards, after the Declaration of Independence is signed, we have a civil war that's in progress, and you have the Lincoln's Gettysburg Address, and saying, basically, it says, you know, he's fine tuning the object of the war into, you know, we are a nation founded on all men are created equal.
Yes. Let me just take that and share with you a little tangent on that that notion of all men or all human beings are created equal. Where does this come from? And I ask that in a way that the atheist philosopher Nietzsche comes to mind.
Uh-huh. Oh, yes, because there are supermen and undermen. And
yes.
Yeah.
And it seems like he was saying that that while he was declaring that God is dead, he was also saying that once we truly do kill God in our minds, hearts, and in our cultures, then this notion of equality of all men will just dissipate because it is not really based on anything scientific. It's based more on something theological, isn't it? Or at least philosophical.
Philosophical, theological, but I think the source of all men are created equal, at least it seems to have appeared in the West, through the idea that all men are created in the image of God.
Well, when you say at least in the West, there really wasn't any nation on earth that was recognizing or practicing this notion of equality of all men. I mean, most nations of the world were totalitarian states. Whoever can get the power, might makes right.
Right.
And there were also always classes and people being oppressed. You know, not necessarily black people, but various people.
Well, yeah, you had people who were saying things like, you know, it's wrong to kill other people, but if they're not our nationality or our tribe or whatever,
Well, the heck with them.
The heck with them, yes.
So then this notion of the equality of human beings doesn't come from the physical sciences. It comes from the theological, the biblical points that all that human beings are made in the image and likeness of God.
Yeah.
Regardless of who you are, how much money you make, how tall you are, short you are, dark, light, rich, poor, doesn't matter.
Right.
You're all equally God's image.
Here's the interesting thing, though. When you talk about all men are created equal, that seems to be something that's recognized as the truth. I mean, if you don't need to be a Christian to recognize the truth of all men are created equal, that all men should be treated equally. There's something that you notice that they pick up on that.
I don't know if that was the case before Christianity really took root in the Western world.
Well,
I don't know if people
I don't know if there's an
that.
Equivalent of the Declaration of Independence found in other societies.
And that's what I'm saying. I think it was the Christian era that brought that to the fore.
Right.
That human beings share a common human nature that must be treated with dignity and respect.
Well, even the whole
notion of personhood comes from the three persons of God.
Right. Even Saint Thomas really tried to take up all that he could from Aristotle. You know, to say all these good things that Aristotle was talking about, but there's one flaw in Aristotle's thinking. He thought it was natural to have slavery, to have people underneath other people. You know, that seemed to him it was like the way things are. You know,
and I think most people thought in those terms. It's just the way things are. Certain people are better at being slaves than they are being leaders.
Right,
and that of course transferred to certain ethnicities and certain races. There are natural classes.
Right.
This is the mentality throughout the world until relatively recently in world history.
Right, right. I mean, all these civilizations that were these great civilizations thought they were the civilized people and everybody else was barbarians.
Yeah.
You know, and obviously they didn't treat the barbarians as well as...
All that well, right.
Yeah.
Right. 978-454-4980. Is the BTS hotline if you want to get involved in our conversation on the Martin Luther King Day, his birthday, and he would have been 89 today. We're talking about his letter from the Birmingham jail and how it relates particularly to this notion of natural law. He was a Christian minister who recognized natural law as the basis upon which all civil law must be... relegated to, and he agreed with St. Thomas Aquinas that if any civil or governmental law is out of line with natural law, then it must be protested against and fought against until it's changed.
Well, here's the thing that he borrowed from St. Augustine. St. Augustine said, an unjust law is no law at all.
It's null and void, yeah.
It's null and void. And
in its essence, yeah.
Yes. Well, a law is a rule of reason.
Yes, dictative reason, yeah.
Dictative reason. So if it is an unjust law, it's not a reasonable law.
Right. All right, here's my question as we continue into the 21st century. Is there a movement today that if Dr. Martin Luther King applied his natural law ethics to, we would also say this is a gravely unjust law that is null and void in its essence and needs to be changed?
Yes, this is something that makes me love Martin Luther King, his letter from the Birmingham jail.
Yes,
is because I am so strongly pro-life. The fact is Martin Luther King talks about the dignity of each human person, each human being.
Yes.
And that is something that we're not recognizing right now when it comes to these tiny human beings in the womb.
Right.
We're not recognizing them as equal. In dignity. We're basically saying, well, it's wrong to kill innocent human beings, except
for blank. And whenever you do except for blank, you know you're on the wrong side of natural law.
Right.
I mean, with the Jews, with the Nazis, except for Jews, with with other genocidal totalitarian regimes, it was except for other people. And you could say with America for a while, it was except for black people.
Right.
Whenever you do except for, you know that there is an unjust law going on, or at least unjust thinking.
And one of the interesting things is that Martin Luther King mentions Adolf Hitler in Nazi Germany. Is that when they were killing the Jews, when they were persecuting the Jews, what they were doing was legal.
Yes.
And we encounter so many times in discussions with people is that they say, well, the law is this. And the automatic assumption seems to be that whatever the human law is, it's correct.
Right.
And obviously, whenever people are trying to change laws like Martin Luther King opposing segregation or the pro-life movement, whenever we're trying, or slavery, whatever it may be, we point to the fact that the current status of the law is unjust.
Absolutely.
And that's why it needs to change.
Yes. So if Martin Luther King was alive today, would he apply his natural law ethics to the preborn, and would he be right there in the front lines of the pro-life movement?
I think he would be. I think he would be. There's definite evidence that the black civil rights movements, like Jesse Jackson, he was pro-life until he decided to run as a Democratic president.
He was very pro-life before the 1970s.
Right. Something strange happened in politics then, and the Democratic Party became the abortion party.
Right, but in other words, the Democrats at the time in the 1960s upheld natural law regarding race.
Yes.
But then they rejected natural law regarding the preborn.
Yes, it's a funny inversion that happened there.
But you don't believe that Martin Luther King was that susceptible to political ambition to be sucked in by that?
Well, you know, he was a great orator. You know,
yes.
I think he would have made a great politician. But he was, I think, primarily, he saw himself as a Christian minister.
Right.
And I think...
The Reverend Dr. Martin
Reverend,
Luther King.
Yeah, yeah, Dr. Martin Luther King. And so I think he would... His political involvement was driven by seeing the injustice that was happening. I don't think he had political ambitions.
Right.
I think it was really just, and in fact, he mentions it in the letter from the Birmingham jail. The fact that they were calling the Christian ministers that were opposed to Martin Luther King, they were saying, "Well, you're an outsider.
Yeah.
You're not a Birmingham citizen, you know."
Right, an outsider without a voice.
Without a voice, and he says, "No. Wherever you see these injustices, you need to go there and fight those injustices." So that was his driving motivation. He saw all the, and really personally as well. I mean, it was not just that he saw it in Birmingham. He saw it in his own life. The fact that he had to talk to his children about all this injustice. I mean, little children could realize that there is something wrong. Why are black children treated differently? Why can't they go to these amusement parks? Right.
And it's interesting how little children tend to know the truth because they're not brainwashed yet by influences that are of selfish motivation. And a lot of little children, when shown a preborn child, immediately know that it's a child and are horrified once they are told that some mummies actually, for their own reasons, kill these children.
Well, it's horrifying because it goes directly to the heart of the family. I mean, you're
to the heart of human life.
to heart of human life is this: if somebody could kill you because of your inconvenient or there's some problem
right.
with your coming into existence,
right? If that's being justified to kill human beings, what kind of civil law is that?
Right. Well, if you don't have the right to life, you don't have the right to liberty, or
to pursue happiness. Obviously.
Obviously, yes.
So, the civil rights movement was a movement that recognized that liberty was being deprived. The pro-life movement is a movement that recognizes that life itself is being deprived.
Yes. I don't know where do I go to add to that.
It's a profound thought.
Right.
How natural law applies to both.
Right.
In different ways.
Well, the thing that I always say is that we look at when is it ever just to kill an innocent human being?
Right.
You know, there's the fact that, I mean, we do have circumstances where self-defense applies or
right.
when we go to war.
But in those moments, they're not considered innocent human beings.
Right. They're
right.
in some way that the other person is an aggressor.
Right.
Of some
an unjust aggressor, and you're defending yourself against them. But we never have a right to kill
yeah.
innocent human beings. And it's ironic, well, it's coincidental, if nothing else, that Martin Luther King Day is on this day every January, and the Pro-Life Day commemorating Roe versus Wade is January 22nd. Very close to each other.
Right, right. And the thing that really gets me about this is you see many of these progressives and liberals talking about civil rights, but they don't extend those civil rights to little babies.
The grave error of our day.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Bob, for your contribution tonight, talking about the letter to Birmingham Jail, from Birmingham Jail of Dr. Martin Luther King. You've been listening to Beneath the Surface.